Ladies and gentlemen, storytellers of all ages, lend your ears to co-hosts Brad and Philip as we delve into the Marketing Your Attraction podcast.
Welcome to episode 16 of the Marketing Your Attraction podcast. I'm your host, Brad, and as always, I'm joined by Philip. Philip, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. I'm so happy to be here for our episode today.
Yeah, we have a really exciting main topic. We're going to be diving into media events, which is a very topical main topic. So I spent a couple of days of my work week this week up at California's Great America, which is one of Knott's Berry Farm's sister parks, part of the Cedar Fair chain, helping them or assisting them in opening the new Railblazer roller coaster. So that was an exciting week between that and some of the filming we were doing at the Knott's Hotel. I was not in my office much, which is always kind of nice to have that change of pace. How was your week?
Oh, well, I'm never in my office. I don't even have an office. So I was at Social Media Week for a little bit. But then unfortunately I had a client visit, so I had to kind of cut out of there early. But that's okay because I got all the videos. So I'm going to be catching what I missed. Just traveling around. I'm in Texas now, and then I'm going to Colorado on Wednesday, and then back to LA for a day, then to Vegas, then to San Francisco, and then to Seattle, and then to Spokane.
Just hearing your travel schedule makes me tired. I don't know how you do it.
Oh, man.
Were there any highlights from the little bit of social media week that you got to attend?
Interesting stuff. It was, how to put it, I don't know how to put it like nicely, but it was odd. I sort of definitely preferred Social Media Marketing Week in San Diego than I did to Social Media Week, because it's less topics, but they seemed really less concerned with social media or even marketing. It seemed to kind of like bleed in a little bit into like the tech space, because a lot of like AI and automation and what's going on with that kind of stuff, which is fine. But I think as you and I talked about, I'm like, I still think there's a lot of strategy, that is missing. And of course, influencers are like this huge topic, and there's a lot of stuff on that. But I didn't see a lot on evaluating kind of like the why and figuring out when, how to judge whether an influencer partnership will be good from an emotional standpoint. Yeah. So that's my critique. So maybe I missed the sessions that I would have been super happy about. Maybe that's what happened.
Yeah.
So
hopefully you'll be able to find some of those in the video sessions and go back to them.
Everyone stay tuned.
Yeah, conferences are always, they're always tough, because for me, I feel like most sessions, as soon as they start to get interesting, is when they're over, especially like the shorter sessions. And, it kind of takes a while to get into the strategy and into the meat of the issue. I guess it takes a little while to get into the solution. Usually a lot of marketing conferences, they talk a lot about the problems, or they talk a lot about like the shiny new toys, like you mentioned, like AI and a bunch of other buzzy words, but they don't necessarily dig deeper into like, how do you apply it? And like, what's the strategy behind it? And, what are some tactical ideas to take out of each session? And it's a hard thing to do. I've spoken a couple of times at those different types of events, and they're really hard to when you're on a panel with two or three people to concisely be able to kind of move a topic forward and get into the meat of it before your 30 or 40 or 60 minutes are up.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't want to go on a rant, but that's sort of part of what really we're trying to combat with the symposium, is that sort of, you're not really ever getting to anything, I feel like, with a lot of these conferences. And I think that's going to, that's leads into our topic. So we'll maybe pick this up, but it really is a struggle because it's, you get to that, you have to figure out the purpose and you have to think about, well, you know, if, cause a lot of them were like 20 minutes and they were just like, oh, here's this like quick how to do thing. And I'm like, well, you know, I could just watch the social media marketing talk show and they can tell me how to use a Snapchat filter.
Right. Yeah.
And that's free and online. Oh man.
Yeah. No, I like what you're doing with the symposium too, because it's more, you know, because it's focused on the attractions industry. Everyone's already speaking the same language for the most part, when, so you don't have to kind of cover the basics all the time. You can really get into more detailed topics and not, you know, not cover like Snapchat filters and that type of thing. Anyway, we'll dive into that a little bit more into the main topic. Before we get to our main topic, talking about media events and just sort of events in general, we have a couple of news items and some quick takes this week. I came across another great article from Digiday.com, one of my favorite outlets to kind of follow digital marketing. They always have great takes and usually pretty insightful articles. And this one was about BarkBox. So BarkBox has announced that they're cutting their Facebook spending in favor of more traditional channels like radio and television. I thought this was really interesting because one of the quotes from it was, you know, smart companies will always be looking to find eyeballs in other places at lower costs. And BarkBox mentions in this article that they have spent 75% of their ad budget on Facebook ads since they began in 2012.
That is a
lot.
That's so crazy. I was telling Brad, I reread that 3 times. So I was like, that can't be right.
Yeah. I mean, there's part of me that thinks it's not right, but I don't know. There's a lot of specific percentages in this article. So it does feel like, it does feel like it was pretty well sourced. They mentioned that in April of this year, they cut that to 25%, which still seems like a lot. I mean, usually in bigger ad budgets, for huge brands like BarkBox and even like bigger theme parks and stuff, you know, usually Facebook is, you know, maybe 5% of your total ad budget, if that. And so I do wonder about that, but BarkBox seems to be growing quite a bit. And for anyone who doesn't know what BarkBox is, it's a subscription service that delivers, you know, dog treats and toys to your house for like $20 a month. So it's one of those ones, but they're one of the bigger, more successful subscription boxes out there. I thought it was just interesting to see that direct to consumer companies are, some of them are going back to radio, they're going back to, you know, print, television, and getting away from social media ads and digital marketing ads. I don't think that's the right strategy for 95% of the attractions out there, and probably most of the people that are listening to the Marketing Your Attraction podcast. Mm-hmm. Because the biggest issue, and we'll link to this in the show notes, we'll link to the article in the show notes, is it sounds like BarkBox has just saturated their Facebook audience. And for them to be able to grow, they need to reach a wider assortment of consumers. And those consumers are not always on Facebook. And so that's why they're looking at traditional advertising. Whereas, you know, a smaller attraction, trying to make a TV ad or a radio ad and get that on the air and everything that goes with that is going to be substantially more expensive than digital marketing. And I would imagine most smaller attractions out there have not completely saturated their digital marketing audience out there for it. But no, it's an interesting article, and it's something that I imagine more digital brands will be combating in the next couple of years as audiences on the internet continue to become more fragmented, and also as traditional advertising becomes more and more affordable, especially with radio ads have been coming down in cost quite a bit. I know there's a lot of haunted houses out there that usually start with radio ads. I don't tend to see a lot of independent haunted houses doing television ads, but radio ads does seem like a natural step for some attractions, depending on the region you're in. Did you have a chance to check out this article, Philip? Anything to add?
Yeah, well, I agree. I love it. I love they're looking at it this way, especially because BarkBox is one of those. I felt like the company was, I almost just said the company was a millennial. It's sort of apt, actually. I feel like BarkBox is one of those companies that I think you see this a lot with companies that were born kind of after Facebook existed. You know, like look at your like traditional companies, you know, that they've had to like shift from like the regular way of business. So like mass media, you know, and then you like slowly win them over. But a lot of these newer companies were born after the internet, you know, like BarkBox was born after the internet just in 2011. They're not that old. Facebook was like the mass media for them. So just like we're seeing other people like kind of like migrate to like diversify. Now it's kind of the weird reverse. So I'm really in favor of it. And I agree exactly with what one of them said here. Smart companies will always be looking to find eyeballs in other places at lower costs. That's like so true, you know, and all that stuff they mention, I love. Like they mention using influencers a lot and doing like actual events, in-person events. And I'm like, those seem like natural, obvious, you know, really BarkBox is for people that love dogs. You know, it's a way to celebrate your dog. So you can celebrate your dog with other people because that's what dog, you know, dog parks, you know, there's a whole culture around that. And you can, you know, celebrate it with famous dogs. And there's just such such out there, you know, rather than Facebook. So it's just really interesting. The whole thing I thought was interesting. The whole article was interesting. It's not too long of a read. I would definitely recommend it. It's just interesting to kind of think about that. And for me to think about the perspective of like, well, this is a company that was like born, you know, after Facebook was already the thing to do. So that's probably why 75% of their budget is just Facebook. Cause that's like, you know, that's how the world, like how, that's how their world is. So it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And who knows, maybe we'll have more attractions for dogs in a few years, right? I know there's like dog cafes out there. Could there be a dog theme park? Moving on to, I don't know. How would you describe this one, Philip? This one is something that we found interesting. That's not necessarily related to marketing, but I think could be a warning sign for some attractions out there.
So this article is called Warner Brothers Crackdown Puts Dark Mark Over Potter Festivals. And I'm just going to read a quote from this. It's almost as if Warner Brothers has been taken over by Voldemort, trying to use dark magic to destroy the light of a little town. Sarah Jo Tucker, a 21-year-old junior at Chestnut High College, which hosts a Quidditch tournament that coincides with the annual Suburban Philadelphia Festival. I just thought this was just fascinating article, basically on, especially for us to think about, because it's, you know, Harry Potter is an IP, and you know there are parks that utilize Harry Potter, but then there's Pottermore and that whole culture, but now there's all this fan culture of events that are using the IP or invoking it in ways to add stuff like a Quidditch tournament, you know, to their Philadelphia festival. And now Warner Brothers, I guess, is sending them cease and desist. It's just very interesting. And it's I don't know. I don't have too much to say about it other than I just found it relevant, you know, to those of you that deal with IPs and interesting and difficult too, because obviously, I mean, this article definitely doesn't favor Warner Brothers.
No, that's true. And I think a good takeaway too is just always being careful with how you're marketing. And when, if you have an escape room, which I feel like escape rooms do this a lot, where they are maybe piggybacking or they have allusions to very popular IPs. There's that like fine line between being inspired by Harry Potter or an Indiana Jones and copying it and getting into that trademark infringement. I side, and it feels like most bigger entertainment companies have been less aggressive about that. I know there's like a Star Wars inspired pop-up bar in Hollywood and Harry Potter inspired escape rooms out in Orange County as well. But yeah, you got to be careful with that, because as soon as they realize that these types of attractions are making money, that's usually when the lawyers get interested and get involved. So as you're thinking about your haunted house, and I do feel like a lot of smaller haunted houses will usually work in IP, especially if they're not charging. And I think that's a different gray area on there. But just don't build your whole attraction around a complicated legal mess would be my advice out there, because whether you're legally in the right or wrong, you probably won't be able to afford the legal fees. And, you know, bigger company like Warner Brothers, they have lawyers that fill entire buildings, and and they will go after you just to make a point. Whether they win or not, they'll usually be able to outlast you in legal fees and everything else. So just a quick warning there.
This is something I got from Audible. I don't know why I got it in my email while I was on the campaign, or how I got tagged for this, but it's like a splash page that was made on the website that they then sent out on their email list. And it's for the class of 2018. So anyone graduating, I think it's aimed at college graduates. It's a congratulations class of 2018. Welcome to the real world. Here's your adulting 101 course list. And there's a quick letter here from the Audible editor. Dear graduate, so you've taken your last final, walked across the stage, grasped your diploma with both hands, thrown your cap into the air, and snapped photos with your now former classmates. Congratulations. If you're anything like me on my graduation day, you're feeling, well, totally and utterly lost, and okay, maybe a little hopeful. I mean, you did get through all those all-nighters and 8 a.m. classes where attendance counted. The real world can't be worse than that, right? Ahead of you lies days, no weeks of job applications, resume formatting, cover letters, bills, more bills, laundry, apartment hunting, frustrating talks with your parents, crippling self-doubt. I'll stop. Things are probably overwhelming enough for you as it is. First, breathe. You will get through this. Now, listen to advice from adultier adults who have been there, done that. You'll be just fine. I love this. Like the, so it's basically, it's like a, it's a curated list. So it was that letter. And then there's a curated list of books, kind of organized by subtopics that they put on here. And like the first subtopic is take a deep breath. And then the second one is welcome to adulthood. It's hard. And there's all these like books on adulting, and there's, so that's just, then the next one is finally lose that freshman 15, and then stop feeling sorry for yourself. Get down to business. I love those. And then there's this awesome playlist of just free clips, which is called, the playlist is called The Speech You Wish Your Commencement Speaker Had Made, which is all awesome. I love this entire thing. I love everything about this. I think this is great. I think it ties into, what we said previously about, you know, thinking about what value your brand creates and connecting with these moments, because we talked about moments on a previous episode, and we talked about thinking about what your purpose is. And it's like this literally combines all of it. And it allows Audible to inject themselves into this graduation moment and really like add value to it. You know, like here are these kind of quirky, but probably actually real concerns, you know, that college graduates have. And here are books to help with that. And then here's a really easy, like free section of commencement speeches in case you think that yours was like not as good as it should have been, you know, like, so I love this.
Clever. Awesome. Well, that's our news and quick takes. Moving on to our main topic this week, we're going to talk about media events. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I was had the opportunity to assist the Great America team with their new roller coaster opening this week. And after that, I was thinking, you know what? This might be a really good topic for the podcast, because we've briefly mentioned in a few episodes ago about how to design a press kit and how to pitch media and do press releases, but we never really talked about sort of that next step of once you get them to your traction, how do you design these media events for them? And so I think the first question I want to pose to the audience is, when should you do a large event? When should you do an event? When should it be like a one-on-one media opportunity, small groups? What's the right size for your event and or for your attraction? And I think the best way to answer that is to try to think about, okay, well, who do I want to reach? What's possible as well? What type of interest am I getting? You know, am I launching a brand new product or a brand new attraction that you know, has the possibility of getting TV coverage or getting a substantial media presence? Or is it maybe something that won't be as visually interesting, but it will take more time to explain? And an example of that would be like new technology or, you know, VR is not necessarily going to make for great TV, whereas, you know, a roller coaster or a haunted house might be. So try to think about like, what's that end result of your media event? Is it a TV clip that you're hoping to get? Is it a great blog post? Is it a tweet or two? Like, what in your ideal mind is that this end result of the event? And then sort of work backwards. So I'll give you an example. Obviously, you know, for something like Hang Time, the new roller coaster that just debuted at Knott's Berry Farm last month, that's something where we know it's going to make for great television. It's the only big roller coaster in the Southern California market this year. It's a huge opportunity for the park because we haven't put in a big investment like that in a number of years. So that would make sense for a much bigger, you know, media event. And it's also something that's fairly easy to understand and to pitch. Whereas last year we launched VR Showdown in Ghost Town, which is our VR upcharge attraction, our additional charge attraction. And for that, it didn't make sense to have a big media event because we wanted to be able to walk through each aspect of the attraction, the technology behind it, give every media person the opportunity to talk with our entertainment team, the VR technology team, and really kind of walk them through that process so that they would understand why this was you know, more groundbreaking than other VR experiences out there, and really understand the nuances of the repeatability and the scoring system. And so that one, we knew that was not going to make sense to have 300 people at an event. And so I think with that event, we had maybe, you know, 15 or so media outlets, and we were able to walk each one through the experience. They had plenty of time to interview all of our creative personnel for that. So hopefully those kind of examples make sense for you. And then, you know, a one-on-one works great if you're pitching an exclusive to a media outlet, or you have something that really you need to spend, you know, 15 to 20 minutes taking them through the history of, you know, of the attraction, or like the importance of it, and really getting into the fine details. When you need to spend that much time with the media outlet, it's really hard to do that in smaller groups and be successful with it. So we'll usually do one-on-one with outlets who are like a BuzzFeed or someone who's bringing a really interesting angle to the new attraction or seasonal event that we're launching, or someone like you know, USA Today or LA Times, who's looking to do not just one or two Facebook posts about it, but they will want to spend the time with you to be able to do a, you know, a 3-page article that really dives into the making of the attraction, the nuances of the attraction, how it compares to the competitive landscape out there. That's where you're going to want to do more of a one-on-one with it. Philip, I want to stop talking here to give you the opportunity to kind of talk about what a great book that you mentioned has sort of helped you design a lot of the events that you work on. Before we start to get into the nitty gritty details and nuances of a media event,
I read a book relatively recently called The Art of Gathering: How We Meet and Why It Matters by Priya Parker. And it's one of those kind of like rare books I think only crazy people like me read when they're trying to like enhance their events or gatherings. So there are a lot of takeaways from this, and I just wanted to run through a few I think would be pertinent for you guys, for the audience, as it relates to media events, which is what we're talking about. And Brad's already covered a few of these. I'll go through these kind of in order. The first tip I want to bring is we reduce gatherings to the things and not the people. I think that's so true with like everything. Sometimes I get myself stuck in that that hat too, where I'm thinking, you know, you're thinking about the logistics and you're thinking about the things that are involved in it, and less about the people who are coming and what they're trying to accomplish. Following those lines, really good gatherings focus first on the purpose, like kind of the real purpose of the event. And a great line from the book is, relating to this is a category is not a purpose. So it's like a media event or a media night is not a purpose. It's a category of things. So then as Brad was saying earlier, when he was like, kind of think about it and work backwards, like you're like, we're going to have a media night. Why? Because we have to have a media night. Well, you know, like, well, that's not a purpose. That's just a category. So what is the purpose you're trying to do? And how are you focusing on the people and not the things around that? And then it's important that you define all that up front and exclude people who don't fit the purpose right off the bat. Second tip is thinking about the size. And that's something Brad also mentioned. There's a few numbers in here that they suggest. They suggest groups of 6 or 12 to 15 or 30 or 150. And 150 is kind of the limit of where you could reasonably meet everybody at the event. So you can think of this in terms of a press event, where if you want all of the media to speak with your team or to have contact with you, then 150 should be really your limit, because that's kind of the feasible number where they could all conceivably talk to you. But as Brad mentioned, kind of that time is much less when there's 150 versus when it's one-on-one or there's a group of 6. The next one is don't be a chill host, which there's a whole chapter on, but I'll summarize it. Basically means, I've done this before too, and I've had events. I think we often think that if we just put people in a room together, they will like magically be entertained. And so you do this like balancing act of like the right personalities, and that's usually never the case. You know, people don't just magically do it themselves. You know, your job as the host kind of begins before. Before anything, it begins with the invitation, and it kind of ends with the when they get home after the thank you note. You know, so like it doesn't end, or it doesn't even stop when you're there at the event. So really take them through it. And when you look at that in the context of media nights, I've been to a lot of media nights where the hosts have been pretty chill, as in they didn't really do anything. They just kind of were like, "Well, you're media, so do your thing." Like do the media. And I'm like, well, you know what? There was really not a lot of like context or setup or like a schedule or menu of events or whatever. And that makes things more difficult. The next one I want to bring up, because I really like it and I think this is awesome to apply to media events, is what are the rules of your gathering? And Priya makes a great, great distinction here between etiquette versus pop-up rules. And she says that etiquette is for a closed group of people or a closed circle or tribe that implicitly understands what they are, versus pop-up rules allow people to gather because they are different and not feel out of place. I think that is brilliant. And I think that's something that we never think of at media nights. It's something I actually discuss in my classes, although I didn't know, I couldn't have like put it into these words previously, but now I know how to say it. But when I discuss this with my class, you know, I tell them you really have to think about what you want them doing. Like, what is the etiquette of your media night? Are they allowed to take picture? You know, like, are they the only ones there? Or is there public there? Are they allowed to bring cameras, to bring equipment? Are they allowed to bring lights? What are they allowed to do? What are they not allowed to do? And I think too many times nobody says anything, because it's sort of like, I think people think that there is etiquette for media nights, but there is not. That, you know, it's not a thing. There's etiquette for like how to eat at formal dining situations, but there's not for like for media nights, you know? So I think a lot of times people just don't know what they can and can't do. And I think that's a big problem. The next tip is to start early. I'm going to read a quote here. "The intentional gatherer begins to host not from the formal start of the event, but from that initial moment of discovery." And I love that, because it's like, she didn't say like that invitation. She said the moment of discovery, because it's really, it begins from the moment of the media finding out that you're doing an event, you know, or find out even about the thing you're trying to pitch on, you know. There's some examples in here of some pretty crazy introductions that probably are not feasible for some of us. Like, did you send them like a letter, or some other like clues or whatever? But I guess the takeaway here is just think about what you're doing to build the experience rather than, you know, how are you doing this? A lot of times my media invitations just come as like a form email that is sent like through MailChimp. And the whole process just feels processed from the beginning. And something that's brought up kind of in the book that really I like is, you know, if you make them feel like cattle, like if you make the press media feel like cattle from the beginning by using all of these like processed forms, and there's not even like any customization, isn't that setting the tone for how they're going to cover your event? So like, if you make me just feel like a random digit on an email list, how likely am I to not just copy and paste your press release? Cause you're already establishing that is the norm, you know? So the next one is, what is your ask? So she puts in here, a gathering is a social contract. And the contract is, what am I willing to give in return for what I expect to receive? I like this too, because I think too many times, especially at media nights, like there's no clear ask. I like also Brad mentioned it earlier, you know, like he talked about if there were small groups and you know ahead of time that this is their interest is doing this article, you know. But, you know, when you have these, your regular media nights, or, you know, what is the ask? Are you asked, what kind of ask are you asking them to do? Have you formulated that in any way? You know, what is the social contract around that? Just thinking about these things and seeing if you spell it out more. The next tip is manage the transition into the gathering. Like as in, is there a passageway or an ushering or something? And I actually loved it because the book used an example from Then She Fell, which I think we've talked about on this, which is attendees coming into that experience are first seated in a reception area and given like keys and elixir and kind of a thing. But just think about that, you know, how are you managing the transition into your media night? Kind of like from the busy world into this, you know, is there a transition again? Like, you know, what is that whole process look like? Are they just walking in, you know, do they have to be there at a specific time? What is the entry like, you know, how does it work? You know, generally, so the media nights I've been to, you just kind of show up to a table at the front. Like nobody knows where it is. You have to hunt around for it. You show up to the table. There's like, they sent you these tickets in your email, which, you know, like nobody can ever find. And they're like, do you have your tickets? You're like, oh, I can't find it. I don't know where they are. And they're like, well, okay, what's your last name? And you give them the last name. And they look up this spreadsheet and they're like, oh, are you this person? And you're like, yeah. And they don't check your ID. And they just like hand you like a button or a sticker. And they're like, okay. And then you're like, and then it's kind of like, well, do I, you know, where do I walk? What do I do? What's happening? You know, there's a lot of like, you know, what kind of ushering are you doing? The last two, I'm going to combine together, but basically think about the beginning and the ending of what you're doing. We talked about this last episode, Brad brought it up too. But I wanted to pull it back in when we're on this discussion of media nights. And just think about when you're doing these events, you know, what does the opening look like? What does the ending look like? And a tip from here that I thought was obvious but extraordinary is don't open or close with logistics. I think it's too many of us do this, where I've been to hundreds of these, you know, where any type of event or gathering where they start off by reciting logistics. And it's like, you know, you really have moments at the beginning and the end to really take control, and the audience expects it, you know, your guests expect it. So did you have an opening? Did you have an ending? Did you have them at the end recall your purpose and reflect as to what happened? You know, how did you take control of these two focal points? You know, and I think that's really crucial too, because a lot of media nights, any media events I've gone to, don't really have either of these. You know, they don't have an opening or an ending. It's just kind of a, you know, it just kind of happens. And there's nobody controlling the narrative or really even trying to craft this as an experience. Anyway, that's where I'm going to stop and go back to Brad and see, see his thoughts on this.
I love that point about the ending. So I think that's something that in the media events that I work on, we could think a lot more about. I think, you know, we always try to talk to the media and say, hey, how was the event? Do you have any other questions or anything? But having a more definite ending, going back to what we were talking about in last week's episode, how important the endings are. What is your ending for a media event? Because usually they just sort of end, and there's always that tough part about, oh, well, some people leave early, you know, before, as you know, not everyone leaves at the same time. But I do think there's an opportunity to make sure that everyone has a memorable finale. Sometimes in the past, we've given out like a gift or, you know, water or like cookies or something on the way home. But that's a great advice to think about the ending. I think so much is thought about of, well, you know, we're going to have this, you know, a speech that starts it, or how are they going to begin the experience? But the ending's not always something that, and it's not always something I'm thinking about. So that's great advice right there. And my biggest thing, for a media event is, and I think you mentioned this a little bit, you have to make the attendees feel special. Mm-hmm. It can't just be a night where, okay, you get a little bit of free food and you get to go through the attraction. Like if that's all you're doing, that's such a huge missed opportunity, because you control the narrative in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Philip, you mentioned this before we started recording. You had a great point about how don't make it one way. Like this is your opportunity to learn from the media, to hear their opinions and make it more of a conversation. And I'm never afraid to talk about competitors and the competitive landscape. Like there's no reason not to, and not to get their feedback about how your event could be better, how your attraction could be better. It's okay to mention competitors' names because they're going to in the article, and it's good to have them voice their concerns about it and have a really comfortable environment of encouraging them to share their feedback. I'll give you an example of some feedback that we had for hang time. One of the media was like, oh, hey, how's everything going? Do you have any questions about the ride? Anything about that? Any feedback about the event? And the person, the outlet mentioned like, oh, you know, I'm really having a great time. You know, I wish you had a media lounge or something. And I was like, oh, actually we do have one. It's over here. And they didn't know about it. and then there was another outlet that was like, yeah, you know, I wish the ride was friendlier for, more accessible for people who, have larger body size. And I said, oh, well, did you have, you know, an issue riding it? And I said, no, it wasn't for me. It was like, and I was like, oh, was it someone in your party or something? I said, no, I just had heard that on the internet. And I was glad that they were able to talk about that, because I said, well, hey, you know what? Actually, the ride's really accessible for people of all different sizes. And, you know, as you can see from, you know, some of our photos and stuff, we tried to show that. And, you know, I'd be happy to have you talk with someone from our the project development to talk more about that and about how the restraints allow that. And that probably would have never have worked its way into being a positive in the article. It would have just been a negative if we didn't have that conversation. And it's hard to scale those things. But you know, whether you have your creative folks or the owners or whoever available for interviews, just let them know, like, hey, make it a conversation, like make the person comfortable. Don't recite the same PR lines throughout the night. Cause yeah, you want to work in like, oh yeah, there's this many stats, or this is the longest haunted house and you know, this area, the region and stuff, but you want to have like a normal conversation too. Cause that's how most media are going to write their article. They're not going to just recite your press release. And if that's all they're doing is reciting your press release, like why are you doing a media event in the first place? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like you want to get that natural conversation going. You want their audience to realize the excitement and the behind the scenes access that these media outlets were given. Using an example from Scary Farm, when we do the lights on tours of the mazes, that's usually an aspect of the event that the media really don't usually get a chance to see at other attractions, or maybe they only get to see, you know, a couple parts of it. And so we let them take photos throughout the attraction with the lights on. We have our technical team, and not just like, oh, the VP of technical services, but the actual people that worked on that maze available to answer questions, to talk about the lighting, to talk about the effects, and really get into those details that make the maze more than just, oh, it's just a scary maze with the lights off, but it really brings it into this work of art that was crafted by, you know, dozens, if not, you know, hundreds of people with it. So those are just a couple of examples of things to think about, you know, for your media event. But my biggest advice is, please don't just give free tickets to the media, give them some food and hope for the best. Like, you really have to create that experience and let them behind the scenes and really show all the hard work that was put into developing your attraction. And we want to hear from you too. So if you have specific questions that you want us to dive into about media events or anything else, you know, please visit marketingyourattraction.com. Send us your feedback. We really want to start answering some questions on the show so we can begin to curate our podcast topics based on your feedback and what you're interested in, especially as we get deeper into the summer season and start getting into the seasonal attraction season for Halloween haunts and Christmas events and other seasonal attractions out there. Before we wrap up, Philip, I know you wanted to mention Great Leadership Symposium that's coming up next month.
Yes, the Seasonal Attraction Leadership Symposium, often referred to just as the symposium, is happening July 30th, and Brad and I will both be there. And we'd love it for you all to be there as well. There's a code for $30 off in the show notes. It's Gantam Insider as one word. The registration link is in there as well. And this is an intense day of learning for professionals in the attractions industry. So, I'm stressed about it, you know, because there's, I'm looking through all my notes of the book, and I'm like, you know, we're trying to move things around to really craft it, and we're changing stuff around. We're putting everybody into cohorts and to do group discussions this year, and I'm really looking forward to people leading with actionable plans and thought through advice that they can apply to attractions. And the seasonal entertainment source just shipped out for June. And if you're not on the mailing list, the link to get a free subscription is also in the show notes.
Awesome. Well, I think that wraps up episode 16 of the Marketing Your Attraction podcast. We look forward to seeing you back here next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.